From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
All I want is peace while my son is being laid to rest. Will you please take a day of silence so we can lay our son to rest? Yes. Please.
That was the father of Michael Brown, the young man killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, earlier this month. Thousands filled the St. Louis church Monday for the funeral of the young man whose killing sparked what many called an uprising and focused the eyes of the world again on racism in the U.S. Margaret Kimberly is a columnist and senior editor at Black Agenda Report. We spoke with her about her recent column entitled American Terror Lives On and more this past Saturday, and we'll bring you that in its entirety later in this newscast. As Washington insiders have been talking about a U.S. bombing campaign against the group alternately known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic Front, both in Iraq and Syria, the Syrian government has responded with a warning that unilateral strikes on Syrian soil will be considered an act of aggression. We have this report from Press TV.
The Syrian foreign minister has warned the United States against conducting airstrikes against ISIL terrorists inside Syria without Damascus's consent. Walid al-Muallim said any such attack without the approval of the government would be a violation of the sovereignty of Syria and would be considered an aggression. However, the top Syrian diplomat said Damascus is ready to cooperate with the international community to confront terrorism. He added that Syria must feel that the cooperation is serious and far from double standards.
The next few days will show how serious the countries in the region or in the world in the fighting against terrorism. So far, we haven't seen any seriousness in this regard. As to classifying terrorists between moderates or extremists, I think this is absurd. We believe that everyone carrying arms against the Syrian government is a terrorist.
The Syrian foreign minister also accused Turkey and Qatar of financing ISIL terrorists, saying Damascus has evidence showing neighboring countries are helping the insurgents. He said Ankara must change its policy towards Damascus and stop supporting the insurgents. Regarding ISIL terrorists, he said Syria had earlier repeatedly warned of the threat of the Thaqfidi group and warned of the spread of terrorism in the region.
The statement from Damascus followed claims by both senior military and civilian officials in Washington that the only way to address the threat posed by the group was to bomb them in both Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, a transit camp for Syrian refugees in Erbil, northern Iraq, is making room for an influx of Iraqi citizens displaced by recent fighting, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The Darashakran refugee camp is taking in Iraqis from Sinjar, fleeing clashes between Kurdish troops and ISIL. Meanwhile, thousands of Syrian refugees have made the camp their home since 2011, when war broke out in their country. The UN Human Rights Chief has warned that the grave and horrific violations being carried out daily by ISIL could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Warda Al-Jawahiri has more.
10 days ago, Bajit Kandala camp was half its current size. This used to be a transit camp for Syrian refugees. Now it's home to thousands of displaced Iraqis. The camp has been expanded rapidly to meet the latest influx. 1,000 tents have been pitched in the past 2 weeks. Bazat is one of UNHCR's field officers in charge of this camp. He's here every day to monitor progress. His first stop today is to welcome one of the newest camp arrivals, an infant born 2 days ago.
So you'd like to refer these cases to protection units so that they can come as soon as possible. They're going to come and visit these families so that we can provide them with the necessary items.
Families who fled Sinjar and surrounding areas arrive with nothing. They moved in as tents were going up. Distributions take place daily to ensure there is enough food and water for everyone. Next stop for Bazad is to check on water and sanitation facilities.
This is a very urgent need for the families. After we relocate the families, we have 612 families relocated here as of today. So we are trying to manage better for the basic facilities, water delivery, latrines installation, and so on.
It's a work in progress. By the end of the week, 400 families will be sharing 100 latrines. The families here share similar tragic stories of long journeys and deep loss.
There are 9 families. They spent about 10 days in Sinjar Mountain. They told me they have left everything behind.
This camp is one of 4 currently being set up by UNHCR and its partners in this part of Iraq. More are being planned. Families living in makeshift shelters in places nearby will soon be able to have a more secure and comfortable shelter. A small step to alleviating the pain and suffering they have endured in past days.
Almost immediately after Russia's humanitarian aid convoy offloaded its cargo of food, water, medicine, and other essential supplies to the besieged residents of Lugansk and the surrounding area, Moscow announced that another convoy will be on the way shortly. We first have this report from RT's Roman Kosarev.
Well, first of all, Russia will continue participating in all of the aid efforts for the southeast of Ukraine, along with the official government in Kiev, the European Union, the Red Cross, the OSCE, and the rest of the parties involved. Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said that this second convoy of humanitarian aid should be heading to Lugansk, or to the east of Ukraine, very soon. The scenario should be somewhat similar to the previous time. However, the process should be streamlined and should take much faster.
The humanitarian situation in Ukraine is getting worse. Any slowdown of aid would violate international law. So we would like to agree on the conditions for sending a second convoy on the same route with Ukrainian authorities as soon as possible. We are convinced it must be done this week.
Well, the first humanitarian convoy is already in Lugansk. The Russian trucks that delivered the humanitarian aid are already back at their bases after spending more than a week in waiting at the border and actually traveling. Sergei Lavrov said that the whole situation around this humanitarian convoy was not healthy at all, and the convoy was suspected of something all the time. Meanwhile, the international press, the OSCE, the Red Cross all had access to this humanitarian convoy, and the process should have been streamlined from the very beginning, but obviously it wasn't. Now, Lavrov also stressed that Russia continuously calls for a ceasefire and is ready to hold talks in regards to that in any given format. At the moment, there are a couple of formats that are working. That's Normandy format involves Ukraine, Germany, France, and Russia, and there is a Geneva format as well, which involves Ukraine, the European Union, the United States, and Russia as well. Now, all of those formats are calling for a ceasefire as soon as possible. Also, Sergei Lavrov mentioned that at the upcoming meeting in Minsk between the Customs Union, the European Commission, and Ukraine, bilateral meetings are scheduled, and perhaps the President of Russia and President of Ukraine could meet and talk.
Vitaly Churkin is Russia's ambassador to the UN. While fielding questions from the press Friday, he seemed to indicate Moscow's growing impatience with the humanitarian situation in the east of Ukraine.
As to the discussion we've had in the council today, sometimes it reminded me of the kingdom of crooked mirrors, because some members of the council were not concerned about the fact that hundreds of civilians are dying. They were not talking about that. They were not concerned about the humanitarian catastrophe in eastern Ukraine. They were concerned about humanitarian convoy, you know, humanitarian convoy. So I explained to them, the effort of some members of the council to distort things, to distort our position, and the failure to look up simple facts which are supposed to be known to them was quite staggering. So I repeated some facts to them. I reminded them that Russia received official acceptance by Kyiv authorities of this humanitarian convoy in an official note, which was sent to us by the Foreign Ministry of Ukraine. I reminded them, in fact, that recently we broke some new ground in our resolution on Syria. We are allowing humanitarian assistance without the permission of the government. I was not making any direct linkages to that, but there is precedent. But the fact is, let me repeat, that we received official permission from the Ukrainian government, and only after that did the humanitarian convoy started moving in the direction of Ukraine. We accepted the crossing point they indicated to us. So I think the thing which needs to be done now is, first of all, this humanitarian supply, those humanitarian supplies to be distributed, and we hope that International Red Cross can help us in doing that. And we are staying in touch through Ukrainian officials at various levels in order to make sure that there are no excessive problems in the process of the distribution of this humanitarian aid. Thank you.
Please. Ambassador, the President of the Security Council, Ambassador Lyle Grant, said that there wasn't a single member of the Council defending your position.
I think there was more than one. The president is not, you know, being a president is a very difficult job. You don't always listen very carefully. And I'm afraid sometimes such things happen to all colleagues. Well, I don't want to point any fingers, but I think that my colleague from China was very understanding of our position. Some colleagues from Latin American countries, again, I don't want to point fingers, but some people did understand the complexity of the situation and did care to look into the facts, and the repeated efforts Russia made in order to coordinate things with the Ukrainian authorities. But we simply could not tolerate a situation where some guys from their border officers who have been sitting there since August 15 and then promising us that any day we can start moving. Now the Ukrainian forces started shelling Lugansk as they did yesterday.
According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, the situation in Lugansk is urgent and deteriorating since the Kiev government's forces resumed heavy shelling in an attempt to seize control of the city. Stéphane Bonamy, an ICRC delegate in New York, spoke with journalist Jerome Langu about the growing insecurity in the area.
We have a team who went to Lugansk to assess the road conditions as well as the security conditions and to give a first assessment of the situation in order for us to make sure that we can deliver the assistance to the most needed. The first impressions on the situation in Lugansk coming from this team were that the city has no water or electricity, that streets are mostly empty and people are afraid. We are very aware that the people in Lugansk and other areas have sustained heavy fightings over the past weeks. So there is really a growing concern on our side about the plight of people in need of assistance and protection as a result of a conflict in eastern Ukraine. And we think that it is urgent for the people that aid reaches people there in Lugansk and other areas.
A new poll in Gaza shows nearly unanimous opposition to any deal with the Israelis that would disarm Hamas or other armed Palestinian resistance groups. We have this report from Press TV.
The poll conducted by the Palestinian Center for Public Opinion says that more than 90% of Gazans thought that the resistance was either well prepared or somewhat prepared for the Israeli assault. Meanwhile, 80% rated the U.S. president's pro-Israeli stance on the conflict as negative. Nearly 88% of those surveyed also supported a long-term truce with Israel. More than 80% said they were in favor of an investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes in Gaza. That survey was based on interviews made with 1,000 Gazans from August the 14th to the 17th.
Can there be good and bad bombing campaigns? Imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal gives us his take from behind the walls.
Bad massacres and good massacres. As U.S. F-18s drop 500-pound bombs on ISIS-controlled areas of Iraq, it does so, it says, to support the fleeing religious community of Yazidis. U.S. President Barack Obama, supporting and indeed ordering the bombing, announced that this action was taken on humanitarian grounds to prevent a massacre of a tiny religious minority targeted by the ISIS army for forced religious conversions. America, the president said, cannot turn a blind eye to such violence used against an imperiled community. As noble as such words sound, they seem hollow in light of the recent massacres visited upon the beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza. As Israel launched an unholy assault upon them, the U.S. nodded in silent approval and acquiescence. The corrupt government in power in Iraq was never meant to fight foreigners. They were supposed to keep their own population under control, the better to exploit and beat them down. When have you ever heard of an invader forcefully entering a country, occupying it, and building a powerful, independent native army or executive? Invaders and occupiers don't do that, for it's not in their interest to do so, not even in the cases of Iraq or Afghanistan, for that matter. That's because the U.S. tried to train puppets bent to their imperial will. As armies, they have only been distinguished by their fierce ability to flee. As we saw just days ago in Afghanistan, you can train a man, but you can't make him loyal, especially to an invader. Massacres are massacres, evil attacks on the weak and unarmed. It doesn't matter whether they are maddened jihadis or maddened Zionists, all should be opposed. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Margaret Kimberly is a columnist and senior editor at BlackAgendaReport.com. We spoke with her about her recent column entitled American Terror Lives On and More this past Saturday. Margaret Kimberly, your column, the column called Freedom Rider this week, is entitled American Terror Lives On. And it begins with a quote, "The legacy can only be left behind if white Americans commit themselves to deep introspection and a pledge to leave supremacy behind." That's a whole lot encapsulated in a sentence. Maybe you could start with a little background, but give some folks that don't understand that they're living in water and that's why it's wet, what that all means.
Yes, well, first, thanks, Don, for inviting me. It's always great to talk to you.
Same.
You know, whenever these murders take place, whether it's Trayvon Martin in Florida or Eric Garner here in New York City and Staten Island, or Michael Brown in Ferguson, there is all this hand-wringing about what it means and why it happens, as if there's something mysterious going on. And there really isn't anything mysterious about it at all. It has to do with America's history as a place of conquest by European settlers, the genocide of indigenous people, and the enslavement of Africans. And a nation cannot dispense with that legacy and be truly egalitarian and democratic and non-racist unless that legacy is first confronted. And we live in a country where the majority group of white people benefit from this history of supremacy. So it would be very difficult. It is possible, of course. But in the absence of having a national conversation about this country's history, then these incidents will continue. You know, a couple of years ago, a group, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, did their own study of the killings of black people by police, security, vigilantes like George Zimmerman, and concluded that almost every day, every 28 hours, right, a black person is a victim of an extrajudicial killing in this country. And I also want to add, there is no government requirement to keep track of police killings of civilians. You can always get stats. The Justice Department keeps stats on deaths of officers in the line of duty. But all of these studies are done by individuals with their own time and just combing through news accounts and figuring out numbers as best they can. There was another individual a couple of years ago in 2012 who said that the police shot 1,000 people in the United States that year and killed 600 of them. Mm. And again, this is an estimate.
Mm. I mean, that's very telling. If the government feels that it is the police officers that are its own to accumulate statistics on rather than the public that it supposedly derives from, that's a very telling self-image, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Well, it says a lot about who is valued and who is not. The controllers, I call them the slave patrol of the 21st century, are the ones who are protected by the system. And a much smaller number of them die every year. It's a range of 50 or 60 a year in this country, while 10 times as they kill as 10 times as many people under these similar circumstances to Michael Brown. And I was obviously Ferguson is on the minds of many people right now. I was a little more inspired after a trip to Alabama, which I wrote about in my column, a state which exists. It's called the Cotton State, or it used to be called that. They've tried to call itself, you know, the Heart of Dixie or something nicer now. But this state only exists as a place where of enslavement. About 200 years ago, the last remnants of the indigenous people there, the Creek and Choctaw and Cherokee Indians, were finally driven out by President Andrew Jackson and others, the Indian Removal Acts. And the state was flooded with settlers from other parts of the South as a place of cotton cultivation, and obviously a place where enslavement was the major business of that state and the only reason that it exists at all. Now, it's not, Alabama is not unique and the South is not unique. The Pilgrims, who we are told to consider our founding fathers or forefathers or whatever, exterminated Indians in Massachusetts. Right. So they're not unique in that way, but it was later in America's history, and it's a more example of a more direct and blatant and obvious connection. Yeah. But it doesn't stop in the South, and it, and you know, people, cops can be in Staten Island and know that they can kill Eric Garner, or they can be in Ferguson, Missouri, or they can be in California where the highway patrolman Daniel Andrew punched and ripped the clothes off of Marlene Pinnock, a homeless woman, and punched her on video at least 10 or 11 times. You can see him punching her in the face. And they do these things. They know they can get away with these things because the system supports them. But this legacy is everywhere. So it can be California or Missouri or Staten Island, and the results will be the same. Without a serious national discussion, and it can't be some mealy-mouthed talk about race. It has to, the discussion has to lay blame, and it has to ask white Americans to change their expectation of being entitled, and to admit that wherever they came from, whether they're ancestors owned slaves, or they came here as immigrants from Ireland or Italy or Poland or wherever, they still benefit from this system.
You know, on that point, there's people do argue that there have been in a number of attempts to overturn this system, and that they apply some historical events that, I, in my opinion, I think it's actually self-evident that they're misapplying just for a lack of knowing the history. But we're talking here, say, your article says the history of black people in America is like a horror movie with many sequels. And then it goes to the civil rights mass movement, quickly followed by mass incarceration. You have in between the history that you know, we were speaking of before, the Civil War, which most Americans believe was fought to end slavery. Of course, we know better than that. And a number of points in time where it seemed the Reconstruction and others, where it seemed that people were trying to address it. And those efforts actually left a legacy of a condition for black folks in this country where they were worse off than they were before in many ways. How do you do something different this time?
Well, you know, the whole system needs to change. We need a new system from top to bottom, an end to capitalism. We cannot have a democratic, egalitarian society. Americans go on and on about how we're democracy, democracy, democracy. Well, we aren't. And we aren't because of money. This is the people who are more learned about this than I am say it is the end stage of capitalism, which is the worst, most predatory stage. And one of the problems that black people have had in the last 40 years or so is that the civil rights movement, the end of that movement coincided with the neoliberal onslaught of the against the American people and against the rest of the world. So we had the reaction to that movement was the beginning of mass incarceration, which coincided with the deindustrialization of the country, which made millions of people superfluous as labor. So the system now makes money literally off our physical bodies in the prison system and any number of ways. But the whole thing has to go. And that's a very difficult conversation for Americans to have, having been propagandized into believing this is the best of all possible worlds and the best system and the best country and the greatest country. And I mean, for people to say this is the greatest country in the world, and so without irony, to really believe that, it will be a very, very heavy lift to get them to see that not only is it not the greatest country in the world, it is one of the worst. And we have to look at a new way of running this society because we are all going down the tubes. I mean, literally, there are people who say we're at the point of near-term human extinction with climate change. Humans are not going to be exempt from the extinction of other species on this earth. We have capitalist system, which does nothing but create an internet bubble, housing bubble, financial crashes. All we have are crashes and bubbles, and they're trying to keep the system upright by starting wars all over the world, picking fights first with weaker nations like Libya or Syria, but now reaching the point of openly fighting with Russia, very powerful militarily and economic power in the world. So this is a time of very deep crisis for this country, but it can be confronted if there's a willingness to do so.
Looking at the crisis in capitalism and looking at trying to establish an order based on a much more equitable arrangement in light of history, how do you see the role of reparations, for example, and the establishment of a new non-capitalist order? There's kind of a weird balancing act that has to be done there, but there's also an organic relationship between the two. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's self-evident that that black Americans are entitled to reparations. When you think about the profits that were generated by enslavement, for millions of 4 million people in 1861 to be working without compensation to for their entire lives to produce children who were chattel to be seen as like human livestock, and their children and their children's children were profit centers, or their very bodies were profit centers that enriched this country. It's obvious, and then to be followed, of course, by Jim Crow and legal discrimination for 100 years more. It's pretty obvious that that group of people should be compensated. I don't think that will happen. It's not possible for it to happen without a sustained movement. And there are people, as we've pointed out in Black Agenda Report, who are now talking about reparations, who aren't really very serious about it. You can't just write an article about it. It has to be part of a larger, sustained mass movement and a means of making demands on the larger political system.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.